My first job on leaving school in July 1951 was with the London County Council's supplies department at both its London Fields and Stamford Hill depots. My brother and I had three older cousins, a set of twins, Alec and Jack, and their younger brother Frank, whom we admired tremendously. All three of them volunteered for the Royal Navy during the war, and all three survived the ordeal relatively unscathed. When our turn came to be called up, we too wished to enter the RN. Stan had been a sea cadet, after which he joined the London Division Royal Naval Volunteer Reserve at HMS President in 1948 because he had discovered that if one served 1 year in the reserves beforehand, entry into the Navy was guaranteed. Thus, by my enlisting into RMVR in 1952 and getting my very first seagoing training out of Portsmouth aboard a very happy ship, the frigate HMS Redpole, pennant number F69, I too got into the Navy for my 2 years. I had also had some valuable experience with a .303 rifle on the ranges at Bisley, where RMVR had its own clubhouse. My brother had been a signalman in cadets and RMVR, but entered the Navy as an aircraft handler on HMS Illustrious. His advice when my turn came was, don't do as I did, the food's lousy. Be a Jack Dusty, then at least you'll be in a position to do something about it. So I went in as a stores assistant, and following our examinations, the top one-third became victuallers, rum, bum and baccy merchants, whilst the bottom two-thirds became naval stores assistants. I entered the Navy at Victoria Barracks, Portsmouth, and received both basic and trade training at HMS Ceres near Wetherby in Yorkshire, right opposite the racecourse, which was, in fact, our sports field. We were put through hell at the York Road camp, where we were physically taken apart, then put back together again in a manner acceptable to the Navy, doing all the square bashing, rifle drill, kit musters, dobying by hand with bars of pusses hard, and so on, then moving up the road to Moorlands camp for our specialist victualling training. Suddenly, life was not quite so bad, and we were almost treated like human beings. Moorlands also had another advantage. It was a Wren's training camp. Some good had come out of our ordeal at York Road in that we took part in the pre-coronation parade through the streets of York and the service of thanksgiving in York Minster that followed. Truly a memorable experience. I treasure the programme of that event to this day. Our Part 1 training instructor, one Petty Officer Garnham, whom I believe we had to call Sir, had been a Barnardo's boy and had joined the Navy as a junior seaman at HMS Ganges at Shotley near Ipswich. He literally was as hard as nails, and at first he ensured that we all suffered. We had to work together as a team because it was quite clearly us against them, that is, ratings against instructors. We very quickly formed the opinion that P.O. Garnham's parents were most definitely not married. Gradually, however, as we became more proficient and after we had performed well during our spell as captain's guard, we began to look upon him in a new light. When the time came to say our final farewells to him, we all went to his cabin, where we saw on his bed an eiderdown on which had been embroidered in brightly coloured silk threads a beautiful peacock. You've guessed it, it was all Petty Officer Garnham's own work. Sent on leave and draft from Ceres, I joined Royal Naval Barracks Chatham, HMS Pembroke. This had been the year of the East Coast floods, and working parties were still active from barracks, helping the unfortunate victims. For Chatham Navy days, I was one of the team at work on the main barracks entrance, relieving visitors of their cameras and issuing receipts. There was to be no spying allowed in our dockyard. My day job was in the main clothing and bedding store, where all those being demobbed handed in their kit. They had all been in receipt of kit upkeep allowance during perhaps 22 years' service, which may well have spent on beer and loose living, but they all nevertheless had to return three sheets, two search suits and all the rest of it. Often they had to visit slops to buy a brand new kit, merely to hand it in a day or so later. I was actually told by my store's chief petty officer, if your kit is not second to none when you leave here, it will be your own stupid fault. So it was perfect. One Monday morning, returning from seasonal summer leave, up at 5 a.m. to catch the 5:55 a.m. bus to Victoria Station, there to board the 7:12 train and to fall asleep, to be woken up by the rumble of the train crossing the steel bridge over the River Medway before entering Rochester Station, then on to Chatham, there to join the crocodile of blue-clad ratings walking back to barracks before leave expired at 08:30. I was invited in no uncertain terms to present myself at the Drafting Master's Arms' office in the drill shed. Upon arrival, I was told that I was on draft to Reserve Fleet Clyde, HMS Jupiter, no less. I had to fly around barracks during my leaving routine in time to enable me to be at King's Cross to catch the overnight Aberdonian that left at 1900 hours. Shortly after 6 a.m. the following morning, I, along with a few others, was in Glasgow and then on board Jupiter in time for a hearty breakfast. The base at that time consisted of three ships, HMS Buchan-Ness, Bulawayo, and outboard of this was HMS Ben Nevis. Most of our storerooms were on Buchan-Ness, whilst our mess, where we slept in hammocks, was up in the bows on the port side. At that time, the only purpose that the tank landing craft Ben Nevis appeared to serve was to provide the ship's company with a cinema. The tank deck was ideal, if a little chilly. Later, however, we were messed on board her. The gearlock, where Jupiter was situated, was regarded as arduous conditions, being tucked so far away from civilization that we actually received extra duty-free cigarettes as some compensation. But as a result, there were no free gangway facilities. Consequently, Liberty men always had to fall in to be inspected before proceeding ashore. Another welcome concession we all appreciated, we always got the very latest West End films as soon as they were released. I was therefore able to write and tell Sylvia from the west coast of Scotland what would be a good film for her to see locally. The Navy at that time still possessed five battleships: HMS Anson, Duke of York, King George V, Howe, and Vanguard, the first named three of which I was able to see every day swinging round the buoy, together with an aircraft carrier, a floating dock, plus two cruisers, either Tiger and Blake or Blake and Defence. The duty I was allocated was the one that the outgoing Portsmouth ratings wanted to get rid of the most, that of Bubbly Bosun. I believe their lordships, in their wisdom, were switching the manning of the base over to Chatham. Thus it was that I became responsible for the daily issue of the tot of rum and was consequently the only member of the supply and secretariat branch that the rest of the ship's company said good morning to on a regular basis, a position of power at last. It was no word of a lie to say that I consumed more rum when I was not entitled to it than I did when I was. One had to be 20 years of age to qualify for it. The strokes that we were able to pull on a regular daily basis worked virtually every time. More often than not, the officer of the day witnessing the issue would be watching the two seamen tankies measuring out the quantities I had called out rather than watch me. I could therefore call out the wrong amount, thereby placing an extra tot or two into a particular mess. No messman would ever query the fact that he had received too much. If I myself was under scrutiny by the officer, then it was up to the two tankies to issue too much as prearranged. To compile my figures each day, I had to work closely with the regulating office, coming into contact with the master at arms, the chief of police, and the regulating petty officer, his deputy, known as the jaunty and the crusher, respectively. It was therefore be wise for me to keep my nose clean and my head down. Even they were human, however, hard to believe, but true. I know I was there. Imagine my surprise when the master at arms, God no less, asked me to sell him a cigarette coupon. Question: do I do as he asks, thereby confirming to him my willingness to commit a misdemeanour? Or do I say, no, I can't, it's against regulations, thereby him incurring forever his wrath? As I recall, I sold him one. I'm no fool. Then there was the RPO. On another occasion, I had been up on a charge and appeared at Captain's Defaulters, having been absent from place of duty, namely the spud locker on the jetty at lunchtime. I was duly weighed off with 2 hours extra work for this crime. The RPO recorded my name on the punishment board in his office, then said, "That doesn't look very good, does it?" Were you thinking of going ashore this evening? Yes, I was, RPO. Well, you can still go if you really want to. The Master Arms is on short weekend leave this weekend, and if his tot is not stopped, you can go ashore. Do we have a deal? Yes, RPO. So it was that the tot was not stopped. I went ashore with my mates, and the 2 hours extra work remains undone to this day. Life in the Gerloch was fairly routine, and I thoroughly enjoyed my work. I was always sober in the forenoon, coping with the figure work, and thereby excused all parades. I ate my dinner through a roseate glow brought on by ample consumption of rum, and could get my head down in the afternoon, proceed ashore for a few beers in the evening, and then do it all over again the following day. The passing ships were a constant source of interest. We de-ammunitioned HMS Relentless after she had been in a collision in order that she could proceed into the dock in Glasgow to have a new set of bows fitted. HMS Termagant spent a few days with us. The old Royal Yacht Victoria and Albert came up to be broken up, as did numerous merchant vessels. The all-welded tanker World Concord, or rather the bows half, was tied up on our jetty, having broken her back in a severe storm in the Atlantic. The rear portion ended up round the corner in Holyloch. Then there was the French destroyer May Braise, which blew up and sank on the far side of the Clyde during the war. She was raised and actually floated away under tow to be broken up. We also had the brand new midget submarine X-51 up with us for deep sea diving trials, she having arrived by rail during 1954. As a matter of interest, this actual vessel is now on permanent display in the Imperial War Museum's Duxford complex. Some months ago, I took it upon myself to tell them that Pathé Gazette had filmed this vessel's trials and that she had made front page news in the local papers 51 years ago. I felt that it would be pleasing if they could screen the archive film as part of their display. I had found a drinking pal, a naval stores killick called Morris, whilst in Chatham Barracks, and we had both been drafted to Bulawayo. We were able to borrow two cycles and could thus enjoy the fabulous surrounding countryside. On one of our trips, we ended up on the submarine HMS Scorcher at the top of Loch Long, and on another trip, we managed to climb to the top of Ben Arthur, or the Cobbler, as it is known locally, and immediately afterwards cycled to the top of the famous Rest and Be Thankful Hill. We also indulged in quite a lot of sailing in 14-foot wooden dinghies on the Gerloch, and one such trip almost cost me my life. I and two others, a qualified coxswain and an inexperienced lad, went out with prior permission in Commander S's own personal dinghy on Sunday the 24th of October 1954. Shortly after 5 p.m, having passed through Rue Narrows, we managed to overturn it whilst tacking back to our base during a sudden and violent squall. We clung to the boat for over 2 hours whilst my companions debated whether or not to swim for the shore. For me, there was no decision to be made. There I was in over 1,200 feet of water in a storm off the western Scottish coast at the end of October in pitch darkness, and me a non-swimmer. I was pleased that they decided to stay where they were, but I remember feeling outraged that this was actually happening to me. I was far too young to die. Morris it was who reported us as overdue and raised the alarm, thereby saving the lives of two of us. The young lad, Brian by name, lost his hold just as we were about to be picked up by a motor fishing boat manned by civilians but working at the base, and disappeared. His body was never recovered. Obviously, we two survivors were exhausted and unconscious when picked up and spent some days in sick bay recovering. I had been punched twice on each side of my jaw, and a boot was brought down rather hard on the knuckles of my right hand in an effort to break my hold on the side of the dinghy. And Fred had fallen headfirst through the MFV's engine room hatch. The inevitable court of inquiry followed, and whilst we were cleared of any blame, the duty commanding officer ashore house hunting when he should have been on board, and the officer of the day who had omitted to enter our names in the duty ashore book and had then completely forgotten about us were not so lucky. Another ordeal followed shortly thereafter, but which the other survivor, Freddie, and I felt it was our duty to attend, which was the traditional auction of the deceased ratings kit for the benefit of his next of kin. I returned to Royal Naval Barracks Chatham 3 months or so later, on Friday morning in February 1955, and did my joining routine swiftly enough to get a long weekend leave. Back I went the following Monday and was finally demobbed, having served a few days over the regulation 2 years, but since I was up the line for some of them, I was prepared to overlook that fact.